when we make some kind of a breakthrough in understanding, it's so delicate. We want to tell people, and like I'm afraid to tell people. I feel better today for whatever reason, and I don't want to talk about why. And I don't know if that's superstition or there's something about, we were talking about pearls before swine before, that if you say something aloud and people don't appreciate it, that it can undermine your own ability to appreciate it. And I'm hoping I've made some sort of, I don't even want to say it, some sort of minor breakthrough. Like, I'm afraid to say that. If I say that, could I lose it? It'd be so nice if I didn't lose it. It would be so nice. Yeah. Mm,
I think there is superstition involved in that, a certain kind of super meaning, you know, stitia being a remainder and super being above, something that remains that we don't want to remain. Aphelia.
Is that what that word means? Really?
Yes, superstitia, stitia, standing above. It's not in the way of things. It's superstitia. It's standing outside of reality. It's superstitia. Superstitia.
Is there also some interstitia to it?
Interstitia. I think that's the realm we want to kind of groove in. And so I really relate with what you just said. And I believe I've been someone throughout my life who's been too ready to share breakthroughs. And I believe there's a spiritual potency that can be lost when breakthroughs are shared. There is also a spiritual potency which can be lost when breakthroughs aren't shared.
Totally.
There is spiritual potency to be gained by reviewing a mystical or a truth breakthrough, some kind of an awareness or some sort of contentment. It's very delicate because there's no sort of axiomatic the answer to that. It seems so situational, you know, and so I know that I've bled out, if you will, by sharing things prematurely. And I'm very uncomfortable with the phrase cast pearls before swine, because of course the swine in this case would be me. I'm literally casting the pearl before myself in a certain way that is potentially weak. Like the swine is more just, You've almost.
I'm your swine sometimes,
I'm your swine. Yeah, and we're good.
We're each other's swine. Well, it's not. It's medium. You know, that's the thing. Is sometimes you do. We have both said I said to you the other day. I really think that Lola versus the Power Man and the Money Ground is an underrated album, and you said to me, I know. And no, I'm not talking about the song Lola, dude. Like, I don't know how well you know that album. Like, yeah, I know you know Lola is a good song. And I'm like, shit, he still didn't get it. I even had this preamble. Like, I want to tell you, Kevin, and I know we've had this conversation about the Kinks before, but I want to tell you this thing. Like, I tried to give you this preamble and you were still like, yeah, no, I know it's a good album.
Like, yeah, well, you preempted it by saying, like, I don't listen to that anymore. You knew what my response might be, which was terrifyingly accurate, which was kind of annoying, which shows how long we've known each other. So that was kind of the coolest part of that whole thing, was like, he completely preempted what I might have said and probably was going to say some version of. And
you still managed to swine that shit. You were still like, no, I know.
Swine it. You see what I mean? Yeah.
Name another song on that album, you son of a bitch. Exactly.
I can't. And I actually had the album for a little bit, which is embarrassing. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. It never became a staple for me. But relative to pearls and swines, and I think that there is an incredible art to reviewing and sharing breakthroughs, and when to be silent and when not to be silent. And I believe that's an art that I am still learning, like on a lot of levels, even small breakthroughs or even stuff that you wouldn't even say as a breakthrough. Was it necessary to speak that? Why are you speaking it? And what's going on there?
I don't want to forget it. I don't want to forget it. I also want to share it. What's funny is in this case, I feel like I shared it first. Like I shared it before I had it. And I do this sometimes because I work in this business where I try to inspire people. And that's my job as a yoga teacher. I try to get, that's mainly what I want. I want people to feel inspired. I'm afraid to say that out loud even. But I think it's probably obvious to people that I'm trying to do that more than I'm trying to, you know, develop their yoga butt or whatever, their yoga abs. And so I say things and I try a lot of things that seem sound to me from my training and study, but it doesn't mean that I have them down. Just like when I teach asana, if I only teach the poses that I can do, then there are some very special students that I kind of can't help. And I have special students that come to me sometimes that are, they're more strong, flexible, enduring than I am. They just are. And so what a shame if they should be limited in their practice to what, you know, my old cranky ass can do. And the same, right. You know, mentally, spiritually, I'm not sure if I'm putting a slash or a hyphen or if that's in a positive or not, or if that's two things or one thing. But same, right? Slash like bodily. I can offer them. Well, say that again.
Slash physical. Sorry.
Slash, go on. Right. Half slash physical slash mental. Right.
I don't know if I'm
spiritual hyphen mental hyphen physical comma mental physical mental spiritual. I don't know. Same. Like if there's some meditative practice, if there's some point of focus, if there's some point of intention that a person can use, even if I'm missing the mark, even if I feel like I wish I could use that tool, but I've been taught this tool or this in light of what I've been taught, this tool makes sense to me, to offer to someone who could use it. I do that, you know, I kind of go through and I try to be creative. I get people who come to the same classes and I don't want to teach them the same meditation every day. But I come to repeated themes. And then I feel like from teaching a thing again and again, I'm finally starting to hear it. The thing that I've been trying to tell other people I'm finding it very useful in a way. And so, right. There's this. So I was the swine. I was my own swine. I can be your swine. I could be other people's swine, but you're right. Yeah. I was my own swine in that, I wasn't able to put it into practice.
As long as a teacher, we're not projecting having possessed, understood the pearl. And if it's a thing whereby we're faking it until we make it, well, then that's a different thing than having an experience and then carefully trying not to bleed out and let it gain spiritual power. And then having the selflessness such that when we share it, it's not to reflect back on ourselves, but rather the pure-hearted pursuit of the truth. So I mean, to me, that's a mixture of two different things. A yoga teacher, a philosophy teacher, or a teacher of theology, or all the things that one teaches, I would like that. One would never want to be disingenuous in the sense of like, I'm sharing something with you that I've attained. And even when one thinks one has attained it, to maintain a kind of deep awareness of one's own depravity as your or indigence or that I mean, so much so that the Christian mysticism or Benedictine spirituality of living with others in community, in either a monastic or a lay situation, you're very much encouraged to be largely mute relative to our own experiences, one's own experiences, and so I think I bring that bias to the table while being a while not living it. I certainly bring the idea of being a little more silent about and letting my actions and way of being almost reflect the supposed realizations or true realizations.
And yet I think if we were a little less heavy-handed with what a realization is, we could take realizations with a grain of salt, and it's just nice to have a little understanding today or a little bit.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's not a big deal. It doesn't suddenly magically make me not an asshole because I'm not. I met a parent this morning as I was dropping my kid off
Met a parent.
Something is obvious to itself.
It's a great technique, by the way.
Yes.
You're there, you're not there, and you're
Right. It's when that which is readily apparent is aware of itself readily. And I saw her, and her son was in a mood, and she said something about Mr. Moody, and I said, look, we fake it for our kids. Why can't they do it for us? But I wasn't really irritable this morning. I was pretty good because whatever, I was going through this thing this morning a little bit. Oh God, I'm loath to say it because there, but by the grace of God, right? Tomorrow, who knows what a mess about.
Well, I'm just having a good morning. Tell me once you share this little vignette. Oh.
No, I'm not ready. I'm not ready.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm not ready. I feel miserly about it, and I'll probably teach it in yoga today. But no one will know that's what was going on for me. Or maybe today I won't teach it in yoga when I normally do, cause I'm afraid to let it go. And yet I can't help but feel, because of the way I was taught, which to some great degree you were, whether we accept it or not, something about the fact that I taught this thing that it's coming back to me, right? We might call that karma, right? I hate to say the word out loud, even obviously we're going to say the word out loud sometimes, but
we are.
Yeah, that there was something about that and it's not, there are so many different versions of karma we could talk about, but it seems okay to say, look, I talked about this thing. I spent a lot of time thinking about this thing in trying to hand this thing to other people. I spent a lot of time around this concept. And then that, naturally became a more prominent feature of my experience. And so then I could use this thing that I was teaching to
other
people.
When you use the word miserly, do you mean also, are you being intelligently protective and perspicacious and careful? There's always seems to be next to the virtue, whatever we're perceiving as virtuous, to be I almost said sister, which would be not good, having been reading this radical feminist stuff.
Right.
Let's call it a twin and not like make the use of a female word that refers to females pejorative, which sure. I think just needs
big
totally
brother.
In the language. Yeah, like an evil brother. How about that?
The school ground bully to the virtuous form.
It's both.
See, that's what's weird, Kev.
It's both.
I'm all of these things. I want to have this thing because it makes me feel good, but I also want it to be instilled in me because it makes me feel good, but I want to give it to other people because it makes me feel good to give to other people, but then also because people like me and that makes me feel good about myself. But also I want people to be happy. And it's not, I can't separate these. I want people to be happy because I want them to be happy with me, but I do want them to be happy. And I want everyone to be happy. And I want to be able to share the things that make me happy to make other people happy, but also so that they're happy with me. And so I do want to protect it for me, but I want to protect it for me so that I'm in a better shape later to be able to share it without losing it. Of course, I want to instill it in myself more deeply because I'm afraid that I won't be able to serve people with it later if I lose it. But it's also true, that's still true, that even in that seemingly altruistic vision of me serving other people, then they will think I'm cool, which really appeals to me.
And I think it's just honest to hold that out. It doesn't have to be the major player, but rather a facet of an aspect of what's happening. And when you talk about the difficulty to separate those realities, that's just kind of honest in admitting the nitty gritty dirtiness of the whole process. It's not like you enter some purified realm. And by the way, that brings up a subject we've talked about a lot, which doesn't really take us into a segue, but might help clarify the way in which we approach what we label or see as realizations in ourselves, to what extent we share them with others. The notion of Christian love, or from a Franciscan spirit, right? This notion of not so much that I am love, but rather that I love. And so there's a push in the Christian mystical life to be like, I'm just good loving, don't need to be loved back. Now I'm not saying that's all treatises on love, but there's a general flavor of asceticism and a kind of the being loved back. If one is a lover, and we've talked about this before, if one is a lover and one's heart is becoming more and more pure, more loving, that lover necessarily would want that other person, friend and beloved, to know love. Because you know, and so you, and you want to be loved back for your own being that needs love. There's nothing, I don't think that the way love, I think that Franciscan love, at least in that prayer, is a rung on a ladder, perhaps, or a way of creating a healthy stoicism, if you will, a healthy equanimity whereby I have loved and I'm not receiving, and it doesn't turn down the flame of the heart. But the real lover wants to be loved back for so many reasons, for themselves, for the other person, for everyone who's around. It's such a vaster kind of selflessness to involve the self.
Beautiful. I'm glad you said it like that, because I was thinking the word egoism or something, and I don't like that word because I don't know exactly what it means. But when you talk about selflessness, but the layers of selflessness, like what a profound, you know, thing it is, right? From a Buddhist perspective, from a Christian perspective, to talk about selflessness, when you talk about getting out of the way, when I let go of the idea of a self, of a me that has to be served, when I kind of like accept a stream, if I were capable of diving into a stream that is love, that is not so wrapped up in who gets the love or who doesn't get the love, then it's not a state of self-denial, because there is still, there's not this being in front of me that I'm no longer necessarily serving in a predominant or a preeminent way, is still a being to be served, a being to receive love.
Yeah, and then it be, now we're in the logic of love, and because for example, we had family here, and you know, I cooked some stuff on the grill, and I've been doing this thing where I just make sure everyone gets some salad and stuff. I serve my so I'm gonna cast a pearl now. I'm going to take a risk now, okay, and share something with you. And it feels like a risk, but here we go. If I want my friends to have the steak, and then there's none left for me, it honestly, at least, it doesn't, I am defining self as larger than me. And so by cooking, literally cooking for many people, which is a lot of my life, is feeding others. So Neem Karoli Baba, feed others. And the act, Master Shun, your sense of self just enlarges by the act of giving. It's not an act of obedience at a certain point. It's not like, oh no, you have the steak. Oh no, you have the last pizza. It's kind of can be maybe where it's not in your mind to grab it because the joy you see that the other person is having isn't really the other person. It's a kind of a bigger you. And that's a real thing. Now that doesn't happen all the time, but goodness, if it doesn't change from what was an obedient act to just and not even a selfless act, it's an act filled with self.
Tell me what you mean by obedient.
Oh, like first to get the hang of not having the last pizza, yeah. You're like, not me, you. No, no, I don't mind. I don't need to be loved. No, I just love you. Not me, you. And you know, both healthy and unholy martyrdom. Martyrdom is a rung on the, there is a quality of discipline required when we're getting over appetites and the sort of selfishness that comes up around the tongue and the eye and the ear. So sure, there's an aspect of obedience to the moment. No, you are not to have the last salad because you have a guest who did not have any or wants more. And so it's like a discipline. I'm talking about where, you know, just what I just said, just that there's this cosmic giving whereby the self is being defined as larger than simply stopping at my skin. Mm-hmm. And having a sense of that in one's life is a very joyous thing. And I believe Master Shantideva goes into that, that it's a little bit arbitrary where we define who it is gets what. How this gets partialed out. There's a little bit of and we can kind of change that line and make that circle larger and larger and larger.
Feels natural though, right? Where we think that we stop and other people begin. I'm moved by the teaching that somehow their mouth is my mouth, but it does feel. I've been better at this before. I think I was good at this as a kid. I was good at not wanting the last bite.
There's a sense, though, in which the artificiality, it's more artificial to land potentially. It's maybe more natural to do the other thing because it feels so good. Like it feels so, uh-huh. I'm not saying, look, yeah. This is not a constant state. This is not even something I've really experienced hardly. It's okay. Just, I natural and unnatural, or it's just natural to say, I don't know, Ben.
Yeah. Like what if you set out to smoke the weed of the smile on their face, you know? I hope I'm not being swine here. I'm really trying not to be swine, and I don't know if I.
Of course not.
But I no. But okay. But I felt a little swiney in that I wasn't. I wasn't sure if I got the punchline of what you took a gamble in saying to me, or if sometimes
I felt a freedom of spirit around not putting the steak in my mouth, not just. I won't, or an act of discipline, or an asceticism that is total joy. Yeah. It means there's just a million levels. I ate less. I saw other people enjoying. I had more energy. There was so many levels.
How can you call it abstinence if in the next moment you experience
you're experiencing fulfillment. Fullness of effulgence. And not only that, like nourished with like, a half amount of food that you like fully not just.
And what does it take to get to that state? You know, like that's the thing what I'm going through today or whatever. I hate to talk about it, but, and I'm sorry, I'm saying naughty words. But I'm so
hate is a naughty word.
to be cautious about talking about it. I'm cautious to talk about it. I'm cautious to not talk about it. But one of the things that occurs to me is that what I'm working with, it's so simple. It's so simple. And that's what makes it hard to talk about also, is it's so simple. I'm not doing it. If I said it out loud, you'd say, yeah, Lola's a good song. You know, you'd be like, yeah, I know. But I'm just hit with it today. Like I just have this feeling of this obvious platitude that everybody could kind of know. And it just seems like one of the most obvious, stupid things I could say, but it just like, I feel it in my feet today. I just feel it. And so what to say was, and why did that happen? Like, okay, Kev. Yeah. Like find fulfillment in taking care of others before yourself. Well,
yeah, that's a total.
Okay. Did you come up with that? Yeah. You come up with that yourself, Mr. Smart Guy?
But boy, really incredible.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. We should start a podcast. You're moved profoundly by it for a moment. And there's a reason why it's some platitude. But something happened that allowed you to be moved. There's this process leading up to it whereby the obvious
is revealed.
Yeah, the obvious is revealed, or the platitude ain't a platitude, or you feel it's like telling someone
it's
to feel
apocalypsed.
Good.
Apocalypse means to unveil. It means to unveil something. You know, it's an apocalyptic moment. It's an unveiling, you know. And by the way, I thank you for saying what you just said. This is a muscle, and it is a process. And it is not feeling at all like, you know, getting hit on the head by an apple and then being, aha, it's much more like a gradual moving toward, and then you just surprise yourself that you don't even need to eat the thing to feel it just creeps up on you.
Yeah.
That's all. And then the other creeps up on you. You just turn into a selfish person who, the other day I was like, I had a certain amount of food in my fridge. Someone came over and I didn't dare. I hid. They wanted some food and I cooked them something and I saved the other thing for my wife and I. And I knew exactly what I was doing and it didn't feel good. It felt tight. And I this visitor doesn't come often. She's going through a hard time. And I did the exact opposite of what I was just, and I felt the smallness of being, and it felt tight and confined and not happy. And it hurt me ultimately. She didn't know any, she was none the wiser. So, I mean, she was not wise to my situation. So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. We're so indelicate sometimes. We're so indelicate with how we are taught to feel good. And I'm like a little fat. Like I don't need to, I'm okay. Like I don't eat the amount of food that I eat because I am in under any threat of, you know, of failing to get nutrients. Yeah. I'm going to be fine. Yeah. Right. It's going to be fine. So that's mostly not why I eat. I eat because I get to, like, because it's reasonable that I should be allowed to indulge at least once a day. Cause you got to eat, right? Well, no, not really. I mean, I don't got to eat today. And which is not to say I shouldn't eat today. I'm not telling anyone not to eat today, but there's no reason I have to eat today. There's no reason for me to eat today, like at all, probably. I don't know if that's true. You know, whatever. Some science-minded person can tell me what is.
Yeah.
But I'm not, I don't know. I don't know that I need to eat today. Like what happens if I don't eat? What happens to my mind? What happens to my body? Like, I know people, we have friends, you know, that when they don't eat, just they get squirrely. Ooh. And you see, you know, it's often thin, taut, strong people that are not shaped like me. But I'm fine. I don't get if I don't eat, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ways that I go to try to feel good, the ways that we try to feel good, what's available to us as options for how we could feel good.
Right. Right. And having the, I think the Sanskrit word viveka, having applying this viveka, this ability to, see what is, I mean, then I would go to the Abhidharma Kosha, it's this old book, you know, the stained and unstained world, like to see what is, what are the actions one undertakes to, you know, achieve true happiness? Another pretty, pretty big question, but what we are taught, perhaps both explicitly and implicitly, as to what constitutes the happy life is probably much of the problem. Mm-hmm. If there is a, you know, to the extent that there is a problem, for you and I mean, I think turning to spirituality or to religion in some way has been a big key to opening that up, like getting into what that is. And still so many years in, not really quite knowing. Yeah. Honestly.
Why am I sad? You know, why am I sad? Like my whole life, like, why am I sad?
Yeah.
And I'm in some ways, cause I'm made to be like, that's how I'm made to be. It doesn't mean I have to be, right? I could be made another way, but it's not, I'm not sad.
What do you
sad.
Mean by that? Made to be sad. What do you mean?
Yeah. I'm not.
What do you mean by that?
I'm not sad by accident. Like there are reasons that I'm sad and I didn't choose it. And I'm not just missing the mark. I have so much. My son, oh, my beautiful son. He says the other day, Kendra and I were talking about something. I don't know. Something negative. I don't know what we were complaining about. Ezra says to us, I think we should count our blessings. Our, you know, this 5-year-old boy says, I think we should count our blessings. My God, Kev, you know, if were I to count my blessings why am I not happy with all the blessing, my life, the things that I get to do, the opportunities that I have, what's available to me? It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. So why am I not just happy about it? And partly I'm tired. You know, I do so many good things in the day and I have so many beautiful projects that I get to be a part of, that I'm honored to be a part of, that I'm so privileged to be a part of. And then, but I'm tired then by the end of the day. And then I just feel tired and I come home and I'm tired and my wife's tired that's sad. And it's my body, mind, spirit, hyphen ellipsis, a positive. I don't know. It doesn't seem like I can quite help it. And then when I can help it, I don't know how much I can help that I can help it. Like it's just as accidental. It feels just as accidental when for a moment I can help it. And accident may not, it feels accidental. It's not, it probably isn't accidental. There's a momentum, there are causes at play. And then when the causes are in place, it can seem to happen accidentally. And to just urge somebody to count their blessings, they can or they can't. Like it's just, you can say that, but I may not be able to count my blessings. I may not be able to escape the obsession with my pain.
I have to say it, where spiritual discipline, daily discipline comes in. It is for me a response to that sorrow you're speaking of that seems to come and go, but in a way to be almost rumbling there kind of all the time, a little bit, like a blueness even when everything's lined up and I'm counting my blessings and things are rolling, and just I appreciate the beatitudes of the Gospel of Matthew in the chapter 5 there, where it's just, there's a way in which we're encouraged to lean into that suffering, and it doesn't feel like an act of conquering. That's why I was surprised when you said, "That's how I'm built. That's how I'm made," was the word. And it was so surprising because it feels very in line with Christ. Mm-hmm. I want to use the word acceptance, but it doesn't quite, it doesn't
have the right. Is this right, like, I accept that I'm a sinner, or like, how is that in line with the teaching of Christ that someone would see themselves made?
Surrendering to the fact that this life, this pilgrimage, we are on a journey and there will be suffering, period. It can be turn us ugly or it can be salvific. Mm-hmm. How is suffering, which is going to come, how do we live a life that doesn't seek to buffer us from suffering, but rather seeks the wisdom that comes through fortitude, patience, courage, leaning into, holding to the difficult, as Rainer Maria Rilke says in Letters to a Young Poet, lean into the difficult and your life will be easy. Choose the easy and your life will become very, very difficult. Lean into the suffering and your suffering will be it will become part of the garden of your being instead of this thing you're trying to cut out of the garden like a weed. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different mindset. It's a different way of being. You're not seeking to cover up the suffering or trying, begging for the help but rather seeing the spiritual opportunity in it. Yeah. Without then creating an idol of it, and then reifying suffering and suffering for suffering's sake, as if there's something holy in suffering by itself, in and of itself, from its own side, which is absolute nonsense.
Yeah,
which is what happens in the cult of Christianity, I'm afraid, and has happened, or at least can happen, and does happen.
Is what in relation
a
to
cult
suffering?
Of suffering? It's a reification of suffering. Suffering doesn't have its proper place when we turn it into a idol or something to be sought. It's something that happens and is implicit in being itself. So at least here in this form on earth here. So some of the teachings go, I mean, maybe it's not, maybe we can find something else there. Maybe, but what I've learned is that, welcome to the party, guys. This is how it rolls.
Yeah,
I'm tired at the end of the day. And when my children were the age of your children, your child, oh my gosh, it had a very much a feeling of hanging on for dear life. Yeah.
It does. Yeah. Recently, anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I felt it slipping through my fingers, I thought, and now I feel like as I'm getting my, for a moment, I have my hands around what needs to be done and I'm doing it. And, but that feels like holding on for dear life. I'm doing the thing, but for what? But for what? If I come home and at the end of the night, like I'm not just, I want to be happy. I just want to be happy with my wife and my son. I want to be happy. And so if I'm not, then am I missing the mark? Am I working too hard or am I investing for something? And I think that my wife has encouraged me to invest. I just hope that there's a time when I get to take that joy out of the bank.
Well, I hope that there's a time when I get to cash in. Now that's, that's a slippery ass slope. Yeah. And just as a segue, COVID has opened up these, you know, I've been a musician. I've had to pack up gear at times in my life and go places. And then you see these musicians with children from various ages. You know, I'm 54 and my kids are almost out of the house. Like my son's gone. My daughter's gone this summer she's never going to be living here again. And something opens up. This last year of COVID for some was like, oh, I've been missing the real party with my children. Oh, what the hell have I been doing? Course. I've been putting money in a bank that you're never going to cash in. Like, right. Wait a minute. I'm never going to go back to that heavy a gig schedule or that, whatever it is. I'm going, you know, and just how people are finding a renunciation, if you will, like finding such meaning in simply being as good a husband and father as they can, or wife and mother. And that's, it's really kind of profound how many people are saying this, and I hear it, and I think maybe some of us have a little better handle on what constitutes happiness.
I mean, my God, if I'm, you know, what am I going to say? I'm waiting to like raise my son and have him move out of the house so I can have my life back. When I think of him leaving,
we do that.
I know, but it hurts my body. I mean, I know, right now you're facing it right now. I mean, the thought, right. It hurts my body. The thought of him.
Oh, that's not what I meant. I meant growing up in a society where you can feel parents, me included, where it's like, oh my gosh, just waiting for the day. Not that people don't experience empty nest, but the whole American family has been the attack on family because of technology from the atom bomb on and before has been huge. Like Indian people look at Americans and like, why is your kid moving to Seattle when you live in New York? Like that's going to be expensive for the plane tickets. You got out of state tuition, and then the family structure. Not to say it's not beautiful to go away on an odyssey, and not to say there's a correct way to do it, but I'm seeing a greater dignity in men and women around their roles as mom and dad as being the most central thing, and husbands and wives, and not their careers, or at least as central as career, and all the ways in which that's changing habits of human beings around me. And like, I am trying to go against the grain by creating this, if you will, lay monasticism, this lay Benedictine life here in Virginia, where it's a sense of real community and people can come here, and really trying to not move so much across the earth and really making a home and not getting a post in Chicago because there's a job open, like staying here and kind of paying the cost for that choice and believing in it in a way that I perhaps was trying to convince myself of as I was raising my children, and wish I had understood more fully when I was raising them more directly. And
some perhaps of us were, you know, jumping far afield. No, I mean, but people are running from their parents. You know, it's not, you know, losing the security of the family. It's a lot of people in their relationships with their families are. And I don't know if this is a modern thing, and I don't know if this is a technology or ease of transportation thing, and I don't know how long this has been the way, but there are people who feel poisoned by their relationships with their families and are leaving. And I don't know that it is at their detriment, that they're leaving to get away because they need that space in order to assert themselves. And it does look like that to me.
And of course, I agree with what you're saying. Everything I said is not contradictory to what you're saying right now. Right? That could be a part of the process. But let me tell you, we're set up for that. That is exactly what we're set up. Secretly, sometimes we want the kids out of the house driving me nuts, and it's appropriate and it's okay, and we need to be open about it. Secretly want them to never leave. Okay, and there's a contradiction there. Yes. Totally. And there are children who need to go on odysseys and children who need to maybe stay in town, and like people need oranges and some don't, like a diet. There's nothing axiomatic or absolutist about anything I'm saying. I'm simply saying we're set up for that to be. Why? Well, you were at work 50, 60 hours a week preparing for some future reality that was never going to be. And you missed me, Dad. You weren't there. You sent me to a public school where the teachers were bored and boring. And you weren't there. Well, you like built homes and played gigs. And then COVID happens. And it's like, oh, goodness, one of us can work. I can work half time. You can. And we can teach our kids and grow gardens. And oh, my goodness. And then when they leave, they're going to let both my children have been very clear. Dad, Mom, I want to live near you when we get older. We're off on our odysseys right now. But I can't even now, of course, something
is this happen. Theoretical or is this something your kids have said?
This is something my kids have said. Oh, thank you for clarifying. Now, that for me, I had to hide the tears. I looked over at Aurora. And I said, sweetie, I felt good about myself. I felt good about my father. I have felt so many doubts and so much agony, man. I just thinking the agony of parenting, and to hear your kids say, whether it happens or not, like, baby, if you meet someone in New Mexico, well, God bless, man. It's not like it has to turn out a certain way, just that I felt the genuineness, and they each did it separately within the last year. And it literally, it made it all worth it, Ben. Like the sacrifice, frankly, of parenting, and the horror of it.
Yes.
Seeing them drive away, just the gut punched feeling that happens sometimes as a parent, just on a weekly basis, it's so much.
It is. I try to, right. Of course I feel this tension, right? Day in, day out. I want to be here for my kid. I try to tell myself I'm here for my kid. And then I feel this tension when I'm with my kid, and I can't help but think the thought comes into my head that if I'm not able to be alone with myself, I can't be alone with him. And he is me, you know, and this restlessness in me that when I'm alone with myself, I want to go out. I want to do a thing. I want to meet people. I want to see a thing. I want to engage my mind outwardly. You know, I'm running from introspection my whole life. And this child, it is being in the home. It's like an introspection, you know, this house, my family is this, it's like my own heart that I'm running from. And I'm very tense around being home, you know, Sunday mornings or something when there's time and then we're going to do something in the day, or Saturday morning, we're going to do something, but we can't go till noon. And I'm like, you know, babe, do you mind? I'm just going to run out and get a coffee because I don't want to just sit around the house. I want to do something. And you guys aren't ready yet, but I just want to do something. And for me to just sit here and we're just not doing anything, but just like being with each other, it's very hard. I'm agitated. I don't want to just sit here in me, which is also them. What will that create? And so, I'm made to be sad, and I'm making to be sad. Not, you know, at the meeting of the sperm and the egg, but in each new day, I am made to be sad and made to not have. And then what? Will he leave because he's looking for that fulfillment that I neglected him? And I know that's harsh. I know that, but
let's, and of course you are and you aren't, right? It's like, I want to unpack what you just said, because that almost felt confessional to me. That felt like healthfully repentant, like admitting of just a situation that every parent and person has been through. And the implications of what you just kind of bass to me, the first one being, oh, yogi, oh, practitioner of spirituality, who's trying to carve out that time for self. Here, I wish I could speak to the 30-year-old Kevin with the 1-year-old boy and tell him, hey, you're already in retreat. That heart, the family, you think you're going into solitude. You're running from a certain kind of solitude that happens built into the family life. And it's almost as if then the traditions and scriptures aren't written for us. They're written for some life that we don't have. The Christian monk, the Christian nun, the mystic who gets awakened, the family life, or the anchorite, you know, on the side of a church, or the sadhu, or the lay person who doesn't have kids, or like spiritual, it's so built in that the situation of having a child, which is both you and not you, and to be able to sit there and find this. You know, I'd remember that, like, oh, we're doing this thing at one. And then the whole morning would be tinged with my aggravation about something that had to happen early afternoon. Yeah. And I just remember that and trying to fight that feeling. That's just like, you don't have to put anything in, Kev. You don't have to go anywhere. You know, that retreat cabin you're thinking about, it's right here on your bed and your two kids are on them.
I think I feel better though when I go out and I get that coffee and then I come back and then we do something. Yeah. That guy, you know, 30-year-old Kevin with a 1-year-old you wish you could go tell him. I mean, guess how he'd receive you. Right? I mean, he wasn't made to hear that. There's a reason that you're the same guy and you wish you could tell that guy who couldn't hear it, even though we're still talking about you. It's not, you know, it's not a different guy. Literally, it's not a different guy.
Yeah. And again, not being, of course, being aware of building the muscle intelligently and slowly such that now as a ripened father, if you will, I do feel kind of ripened. I just don't get bored. Admittedly, they're older, but it just doesn't come up like it used to. The joy in that because of some more love of self, and especially with my son, who seems so much closer reflection than my daughter, who has both been of myself and other in a way that my son is not. And I just would like to say, at the risk of being politically incorrect, it's a completely different, for me, it has been a completely different reality with a son and with a daughter and raising them. There are ways in which they're very similar, but they're different. I see it's not completely different. So there are ways in which it's a profoundly different thing with a son for me. The identification is heavier and the mixed upness of it is also heavier. And the confusion that comes with that and the lines between self and other are far blurrier. And I see my own afflictions bore out in his suffering and afflictions. And I pass that on to him like a disease. And I also passed on good things. And then we live with that like reflection, like our heart outside of ourselves. Yeah. Like your son and daughter is like your heart is outside of yourself walking around and could get hit by things and get cancer and be blinded and crazy stuff, right? And so,
and they do get hit by things, and
you see, and they do, you know, and then that stuff happens, and it just,
and it's kind of, and he's kind of not me, but he's kind of me. He's the closest thing to someone outside of me who sort of happens to be me, and he gets all of the complications that come with that, right? All of the complications in the way that I treat myself, which is complicated, Oh, dude, it's so weird. My attitude towards me is so weird, and it's so, I'm just dumbfounded anew each day at how hard I have been on myself. And at the same time, I don't want to say that because I don't want myself to get carried away. Like I give myself too much and too little credit, or I give myself too much credit for giving myself too much credit, or too little mm-hmm. credit for the self-effacement. Like, it's okay. You figured it out, Ben. If you 45 years of practice, congratulations, you figured out how to be self-effacing. Like, you were worried maybe that you wouldn't keep yourself in check, and you did, Ben, you know, like you.
What self did you keep in check? Wait a minute now. mm-hmm. I couldn't say what you just said.
I don't think I could have until very recently, and I may change my mind tomorrow, but I have a tendency to want to rein myself in, and I don't have a tendency to rein myself in from what, right? Like rein myself in from excessive self-praise, or thinking too much of myself, or thinking too much of my potential, or thinking too much of myself relative to others. And when I go down like that, sort of self-praise is so, the sort of self-praise that I have been steering against is so superficial now compared to the sternness with which I have kept myself in check, that now the keeping myself in check is the dominant feature. Now I mostly am just giving myself a hard time. Now I'm mostly just kind of being a dick to myself, and I'm not doing the other thing that I'm trying to keep in check. I don't know if I ever did, you know, maybe as a teenager, or maybe, you know, I remember moments, like I remember fleeting moments in my life, and I can go to different parts of my life and see them. Hmm. And you've been there for some of them, but mostly not. Mostly when I look inside, even those moments were sort of like overcompensation for like, well, I'm a dick and a mess, but at least I can do this. I know I can do this. Like even those moments of self-praise were to make up for what I saw as my vast shortcomings. I don't want to treat him like that. And there's this tendency to treat him like that. And then to like give myself full attention feels masturbatory, self-indulgent. And what's weird is I almost want to say like incestual or something to be loving to myself, which is so fucking weird. But it's like grody, like I'm somehow like turned off or offended by being loving to myself. And
I have to ask though. Yeah. I'm struggling with what you're saying.
Okay.
I can't see a spirituality or a world or any spirituality without an active self-denial in the beginning phases of the spiritual life. I cannot see a spirituality separate from asceticism, and the asceticism that questions how much I put in my pie hole, how much visual stimulus I need, how much mental stimulus I need, how much sexual stimulus I need. And I think that to have an awareness of how things are, I need to dial back my desires significantly. Why? So I can really taste and really see and really touch and really feel and really make love. The soul here, you said it, I'm made that way. The soul is conformed with a certain violence and a certain imprimatur, there's a certain way in which we are, I have to fight against the stream of my being every single day. And it is so sacred, and it can be done unintelligently. It can be an act of low self-esteem or an intelligent self-denial. And God help me to know the difference. And God give me friends to let me know when I'm being inappropriately harsh. And God help me to know what proper self-love is and what proper self-denial. Of course, there's all these, yet I can't envision a world where at least this pilgrimage, this little testing ground, this little rental unit called Kevin doesn't have to wake up and just not have the second cup of coffee. Just eat one egg instead of two, and then feel the immense satisfaction of being light. But food's just an example. How many songs do you need, Kev, to listen to? What is health? What is proper amounts? What is moderation? And why does such joy come on the heels of moderation? Why are they always connected? And why also can it seem to be that asceticism or moderation can lead to a tight-assness that seems not to enjoy anything, and such that on the heels of that is a bunch of self-flagellatory nonsense that puts you, you know, in psychological hell? So I don't know.
I can throw all the pizza and potato chips and songs and indulgences on top of the flame that is me and not enjoy a lick of it as fully as, you know, as someone who loves themselves. Like, these are distractions from loving myself. Yes. And that when we talk about self-denial, right? I mean, geez, it's such a loaded term. Could be so, right? Denying could be denying the existence of a self, or denying the indulgences of a self, or and these are related. But what I'm saying is that the ways in which I'm harsh on myself include running to indulgences, because of those allow me to not dwell with myself. Those allow me to not spend time with myself. I'm spending time with pizza instead of Ben, instead of sitting and holding the hand of this child who grew up in pain, who is me, who feel uncomfortable to look myself in my own eyes. Mm-hmm. And that denial is sick. I mean, is it sick in that it's a malformity? I don't know. I mean, it may be normal. I don't know what's normal. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's normal. I'm not in no place to say.
Neither do I.
But I run from intimacy with myself to these indulgences. My point is not like it's okay, Ben, have a 37th piece of pizza, which I could do probably. My point is, like, Ben, you know, what would it take to hold your, imaginary self that is not imaginary, right, in your own arms, and stroke your own hair and hold yourself while you cry and say, it's okay, Ben. It's okay. Mm. It's okay. You're doing good, Ben. You're doing good with what you have. There's a lot set in motion here. It's okay, Ben. There's so much. It's so much bigger than you, Ben. And you are just a tiny piece playing your tiny role in this grand thing. And it's okay. And take it easy, man. You're good. You're good. It's okay.
I studied with a Sufi sheikh who used to go, he looked at me, he goes, shwaya bi shwaya. And I was like, shwaya bi shwaya, that sounds nice. He goes, yeah, you need it. Take it easy, bro. Yeah, it's like be cool in Arabic. Shwaya bi shwaya. Like, and this kindness, Now, for me, Ben, like, the acts of moderation or little victories, they seem ultimately so kind to the self. And I think where you've gone is really beautiful and can almost act as a litmus. After you did the fast, did you feel kinder to yourself and so others? Were you more conformed to love and not aggression? Are you undertaking this practice as a spiritual athlete? Or is there a way in which, you know, you can kind of tell, right? Like, say if you're doing your morning, something in the morning, like your yoga or some kind of thing you call a practice, and you get interrupted and you just feel this eruption of love in the interruption for yourself and the other person. You don't like, or you feel the opposite and you're like, gee, I wasn't anywhere near what I was, the purity of heart I was seeking to do by undertaking the practice or eating the piece of pizza. Like, I'm nowhere near. Like, if I'm really enjoying and loving myself and eating, then when someone goes to grab the last piece of pizza, you feel this incredible joy when they grab it. But if I'm eating it and running away from myself, which I know really, really well because I'm indulgent by nature. It's a terrible thing because you don't even get to enjoy the, it like mm-hmm. ruins it all. Mm-hmm. It just ruins, I don't even get the, you know, the joy of having eaten the bloody pizza at that point. It's just, and I know we're tiring this metaphor out, but it's just like, it just, you know, as applied to so many levels, like, I don't know.
I don't know, though. I don't know that we are tiring the metaphor out. I mean, it's not really a metaphor. I mean, I know it sounds so base to talk about.
No, not a metaphor. The reality.
No, because it sounds right. That's the thing. It sounds so base. Like, are we just talking about food? But boy, it's so big. I mean, it seems so mundane to talk about the role that food plays in our escape. Our escape from the self. It's so funny because we're talking about the ideal of escape from the self, but there's the fault of escape from the self.
And the evil brother.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The mean school ground bully.
The mean school ground bully, which could be male or female.
Sure, right. That,
or androgynous or a they or a binary or anyone. It could be any of those, any of the above. Could be a school ground bully.
Self-denial, right, is easily a poison. Easily, so easily a poison. I mean, like, and you said this, right, that there's a tightness or a stinginess that comes along with it. But the escape from the self, there's this being right there before us all the time. And if we are... There's a sacredness to humanity, it seems to me, and I think it seems to you. And I don't know, we could say that emanates from God, and I know that people feel that, and I have my own feelings about, I don't know how to articulate my sense clearly, or maybe I could try, but I do, the point is that I do feel a sense of the sacredness of
being.
Of souls, which I don't even necessarily accept such a thing.
Would you say a being, for goodness? Esse, the Latin esse, E-S-S-E, just the sacredness.
I'll allow it for now.
The fact that we are is just necessarily sacred. That's.
And here I am as this custodian of being, and I look for beings to serve, and I look for beings to care for, and here I am. Mm. And there's this being before me that I seem in particularly to be, and that's true of my wife, and it's true of my son, and it's true of my friends, and it's true of my parents, and it's true of the people around us. But holy shit, there's this one that's there always, always, always. There's this one that's there alone with us every time we went to the bathroom.
Oh.
And that one... How are we this perfect, precious child who is as blameless as each and every one of us, exactly no more and no less, as each and every one of us is blameless. And I turn a blind eye to their pain. I try so hard to turn a blind eye to their pain. I try so hard to turn away, to not look them in the eyes, to force pizza down my gullet so I don't have to sit with how they feel or what they're going through. And they're so desperate to be heard by everyone outside, everyone outside of their captor, of their prison keeper, of the, right?
And then,
there's no, right, that there's this gulf, right, that this child in me has to somehow get across to find people to receive him. And
it's, I like your third person use there. Pardon the interruption.
Third person use there.
And then this is where, for me, God comes in so clearly, because there is a way in which, for me, I am not the creator of myself and God is wholly other. And then there's a way in which we can be and become entirely God. And that tension is always there in all the monotheistic religions. But for me, what's helped me with the very process you're talking about is a conversation with God, which is a conversation with my deepest self. And then the horrible, the paradox of being, which is to truly love the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to remember the self. And then to remember the self is to finally love the self. Like, it's this strange thing. But in the meantime, I still can't look in the mirror, Ben, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, with love. Mm-hmm. I cannot look in the mirror. This is as basic as pizza. Like, yes. The mirror in the morning, the one we all have before our face. I brush my teeth and I look away. Still to this day, some deep-rooted shame. And then even after perhaps being told you're loved and you're loved irrespective of your worth or what you think you're worth, you may even hear your parents say it or the angels say it or whatever. You can't look in the mirror? Mm-hmm. Really? And so... And then what you said, like, and then there's this, your own heart is outside yourself in the form of Ezra, your son, or Samuel, who, my son, who's just left home. And I got to hold it. I'm barely holding it together listening to you right now. I got to be honest. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't get back any of these days with Ezra. Mm-hmm. Fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, shit.
Yeah.
You know what I wouldn't do to have, you know, Sam or Isabella just, you know, tug on my jeans and say, come swimming with me. And I'm like, I got Dharma to study, man. I got to prepare for a trip to this. And I got to teach this thing on it. I got people. You know, we got a sangha in Charlotte. I got this thing to do. I got those stuff. Dad, will you come swim? What I would not do. Now, Aurora says, yeah, but like half the time you were the dad playing with the kids. And I don't know if it was half the time, whatever. Just not that it's real. I'm not saying we should always like say yes to our children. That's not what I'm saying. Just hearing you talk, I cannot get those days back. Mm-hmm. I cannot. And, you know, he's just, it just hit me, you know, just, this is, he's just left, you know, and it doesn't mean, you know, it grows over the years and we've got the, you know, and we do just the preciousness of our time with our wives, who could be taken from us at any moment, mm-hmm, or our children. And then the fact that, you know, brother man,
you should be able to look in the mirror and love yourself before you had kids. I'm just saying. Like, I hear that voice too. And that voice comes to the party. What business do you have having kids? Like, what business did you have? But then I'm like, but I had them and I tried. And I'm trying.
You are.
And
you are. And that guy's still in the mirror. You know, he's still in the mirror.
Still
I'm gonna
there. Come
home. I'm gonna pick up my kid from school today. I'm gonna bring him home. I'm gonna feed him. I have to go out tonight. He's gonna want my attention. He's gonna wanna talk the whole time. I'm gonna wanna be alone with my thoughts, or I'm gonna wanna think about something else. He's just gonna want me to pay attention to him.
Which is totally valid.
I'm gonna make him some food. He's right there. Yeah. He's right there. He wants my attention. He's right there. He just wants my attention. You know, this guy in the mirror, he's right there. He's right there. You know, like you can't
this
have the
guy
days
in the
back
mirror, right there.
You can't have the days back with your kid. What about the guy in the mirror? You know, like, when are you going to say, when are you going to look back and say, I can't have the days back with the guy in the mirror? When are you going to look
then,
back?
And then knowing that the beautiful process of having my children, yeah. I get glimpses of looking in the mirror where there's love.
Yes.
Because, my gosh, I did love another being. I do love another being. Like, I know love. I have loved. And then, and building this beautiful relationship that you're going to have your whole life, whether it's a day we live or another 40, 30 year, whatever it is. And so I don't get too forlorn, you know, because it seems that this work in progress gets more obviously beautiful and sacred with each passing year, and trusting that and knowing that there's dips and times where it doesn't feel like that's happening, but overall, and that's been, there is a solace for me there. There truly is. Like, my son and I, for our struggles, it's real. It feels like we stay real with each other. But I do still, like, I remember Michael Brannon, his first teacher said, you need to just look in the mirror for a month. Just, you have a, go into that retreat cabin we have for you, and for a couple hours a day, just look and just say, I love you. And you're just, don't look away. Try, you'll look away, but just keep looking. And Michael was, you know, highly intelligent. Mm. And he was like, that, you know, in his mind, it's like, that is the dumbest shit I ever heard. I cannot. I mean, are you kidding? Oh my God. Like, he really like had heavy, and he said, okay, I'm going to try it. For a half hour, not just 2 hours a day or whatever it was. And, oh, he did 5 minutes the first day, and I guess he got up to a certain amount of time, and it changed his life. It changed everything. And that sounds very kind of, what I want to say, Ben, mechanical. You know, it sounds like a trick, like a carpenter's trick for getting something, you know, like a trick. And it is. It's totally, and I think there might be something to it.
I mean, as opposed to what, right? I mean, it's a trick as opposed to what? How are we supposed to make, like, is what's not a trick? What would be the way that wouldn't be a trick? That, like, under what circumstances would we be allowed to deserve that love? Like, what do we think when we say, like, oh no, that's cheating or something, or like, we don't deserve to get it that way because we just used a trick? But like, what do we think would be the version where we would deserve it?
Wow. I see. I wanted to jump on that from a, if I may say, I mean, probably the other perspective, but from a Christian perspective, or from what I believe to be the perspective of Christ.
And but that's probably saying too much, but I will say, and I don't know if this is a pearl or not. Hey, Kev, that's me. Hey, Kevin, you know what? You're never going to be satisfied when you look in that mirror. I'm just telling you. There's a deeper love that you could tap and you could look in that mirror. But the self that you want to be loved, that you want, the self that you want to have loved is the self that has to go. I'm sorry. You are loved. God is love. And you have been loved forever. But the self you're trying to love, not that it doesn't exist. The self you're trying to love doesn't, I don't know how to say it. And there is compassion in that. And that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't love the self that is spun around anxieties or an identity that's spun out of false fears, the self that is spun around false honors and false hopes, the self that we spin around all kinds of narratives that don't perhaps, that perhaps aren't even that healthy. Or do we have to love that self? Can we love that self? I don't know. I don't know what it means to love the right self or the wrong self. I'm a broken self that can't even tell the difference.
Well, that's the thing. We can't, so, like what we've shown over and over in this conversation is that we can't speak the word self without equivocation, because we want to talk about the experiencer of love and joy, the sharer of love and joy, who is not the story of the rights and wrongs that have been done to me, and thus the experiencer or sharer of love. And the story is kind of bullshit, but it's not totally bullshit. There is a story, and that is a guy when I tell that story, but is the story the actual guy? Maybe not, but I don't know how to talk about the actual guy without telling the story. So for me, they're kind of the same guy. And so I have to use the story to engage with the self. I don't have another mode. I don't have the capacity. It doesn't seem talk about Ben without engaging in this, you know, teetering tower of artifice about who is Ben, this, system of symbology.
Yes, yes. But at least, and maybe holding delicately this teetering, tower of artifice. Like, look, what do you want me to do, man? Like, it's a story. It happened. What do you want me to say? You want me to become this distinguisher between the real self and the false self? Give me a break. Like, but we do have to try. We do have to make, I do believe we have to create a small S and a big S, and maybe go beyond a small S and a big S, and maybe look from the place beyond small S's and big S's at big S's and small S's. And then maybe switch the big S with the small S, such that what you thought was the big S is actually the small S, and the small S is actually the big S. I don't know. Like, and that's where I turn to you and to friends and to guides.
Same.
And to Christ. And to whatever, and to different forms of, to Buddhism, to Buddha, and to different things, to my wife, and generally, like the I find the teaching to be right in the children and the relationship. There's so much more in the actual stuff of life than I think I knew when I was studying the path as something outside of myself that I was putting into myself, rather than the path naturally emerging from the exigencies of life, just the stuff that comes up. And instead of trying to find a purity or a kind of
another realm or something. Yeah. Not looking beyond the kids on the bed on Sunday morning and still looking beyond the kids on the bed on Sunday morning. like, can we do both? You know, I don't know.
I mean, it sure seems like it's, you know, both continued to be a part of it. I don't.
Seems like it. Yeah.
I don't see how, it doesn't seem to me wildly likely that the little bits of understanding that have dawned over time would have happened without me spending a lifetime looking for understanding and having thoughts around what it would be to find understanding, that life itself would have accidentally supplied that without me wondering and seeking, which may also be an accident. And so again, I find that when I have some minor breakthrough, and that's what's cool about this moment that I'm having, which could be an epiphany to last a lifetime or not, or I may not be able to hold it tomorrow. And the thing that's encouraging about it to me today is it's not that big a deal. It's not big. It's just like a place where I could see myself slowly chipping away. It didn't suddenly change everything. It didn't suddenly make everything okay.
Yeah.
It didn't suddenly.
Yeah.
But there's some room there to work. A job, a path opens up before me that definitely would need to be walked. It's not that something opened up and now I don't have to walk a path. It's that a path with a lot of work ahead has come, and that probably came after a lot of work. And it sort of feels like an accident. I didn't decide that today would be a day that I would hear what I've been trying to say to myself, or what other people have been trying to say to me, or both, or what I've been trying to say to other people. But maybe I kind of heard it a little bit, and maybe I've been, looking for, like, knowing how to put things into practice before I knew what to put into practice. And maybe today I have something to put into practice. And it's a lot of these things. I mean, it's no one practice. It's so many practices, and self-kindness is just, boy, is it at the heart of that. And boy, do I want that for people. Like, I love people. I love people, and I don't want my wife or child to be hard on themselves. I love them. I want to be so tender with them. I want to be so tender with my son. And you've been a big inspiration for me, honestly, in your tenderness with your son. And I don't, I know that none of us do it perfectly, but I try to be so tender with my son and so loving and gentle with him. And I want my wife to see me that way. I want my wife to receive me that way. And so don't I want her to treat herself that way? Like, what do I want for her in the bosom of her own mind and heart, right? I want her to be nurtured wherever she is. I want, when I think of the way that her family has mistreated her, and I want to care for her in a way that she wasn't cared for, because she's so beautiful, because she's so good, and I see how good she is, and I see what she deserves, and I see how pure my son is, who is so good. I just cannot fucking believe it. He's so good.
And
I want such sweetness for him, and I can't be there for them because I'm not them, because I can't always be there for them, and also because I don't have the capacity to be as loving for them as I want them to have. So I wish that he could do that for himself. I wish that she could do that for herself. I wish that she could be there reminding herself that she is loved, telling herself that she has loved, because she is loving herself, because he is loving himself. And then And then I am a hypocrite if I cannot, will not provide that for myself.
Right. And I'm feeling, as we go deeper into this subject, that it's not possible in a certain way to love the self. There feels like there's something more fundamental in reality, in the nature of being. And what I mean by not possible to love oneself, it's fully possible, I think, to love the self and other, but it's not possible to do anything that would, it's not a matter of looking in the mirror and being satisfied. It's not a matter of looking in the mirror and being like, it's looking in the mirror with everything that one is to, or I'm just stabbing here. I don't,
and how is that not love, this thing that you're pushing towards? You know, right. I'll accuse you of this thing that I have a tendency to accuse you of, which is, over nuance. Like, can we love ourselves before we contradict that we could love ourselves? We're so bad at it.
I know. I wanted to go somewhere just saying that the fundamental nature of being is love. It's not neutral. And I think it's so close to us, like a fish being asked about the ocean and the fish responding, I don't know what you're talking about.